Hey guys, welcome to Thrive Bites, the official podcast of Dr. Colin Zhu, aka The Chef Doc. On every episode, I talk with health and wellness experts from all over the world, such as doctors, chefs, dietitians, coaches, and many more. And I sit down with them and have casual conversations about plant-based lifestyle, how to elevate our emotional resilience, and what it really means to thrive. And I bring all of this to you. So let's get to this week's episode.
Okay, guys. Well, welcome to another episode of Thrive Bites. I'm your host, Colin Zhu, and thank you so much for hopping on. Today, we have a wonderful, wonderful guest with us today. This is Dr. Uma Naidu. Say hi to everyone, Uma.
Hi. Hi, Colin. Hi, everyone. It's great to be here.
Oh, yes. I'm so excited for her to be with us today. So Dr. Naidu, if for those of you who do not know who she is, she basically founded and directs the first hospital-based nutritional psychiatry service. And she's also the director of nutritional and lifestyle psychiatry at Massachusetts General Hospital, the world-renowned hospital, and the director of nutritional psychiatry at MGH Academy, and also serves as their faculty. And she's today considered Harvard's food mood expert, and she's been featured on many publications such as Wall Street Journal, and she has a new book called This Is Your Brain on Food. And definitely would love to get into that more later, but I want to learn more about you. Thank you so much for being on the show. And thank you for, you know, spending some time out to be able to share your wisdom and expertise with us today.
Thank you, Colin. Thanks for inviting me. And I'm excited. And thank you for the work that you're doing.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I think, you know, we're in 2020 in the age of the pandemic and, you know, really focusing on community and togetherness. And It's definitely changed our healthcare landscape a lot. And I feel that more so now we need more collaboration and need more just conversations like we're about to have to be able to kind of further the work that we do. We were talking offline about, you know, each other's work. And, you know, I'm just really excited about, you know, what you have going on. So, and you're calling from Boston. So let's start off. I love hearing about people's origin of story and how they got from point A to point B. And what I would love for you to share with us, with the audience about, you know, what got you first initially started to go into psychiatry and then how you evolved into integrating nutrition and food into your practice?
Thanks, Colin. That's a great question. I found myself in medical school just naturally attracted to speaking more with people and trying to find out more about really what they were thinking and how the brain worked. So I was sort of attracted to that aspect in medical school. And I also came from a family of physicians and was surrounded by medical talk all of the time. But also, I think one significant factor is I was also from a very large extended family, Indian in origin, and there were always multiple cooks and lots of love around food in the kitchen. So food and nutrition was very much a big part of how I grew up. When I decided to apply for residency in psychiatry, I didn't know how to cook properly. And that was because I came from a large family where I was spoiled by mothers and aunts and grandmothers all cooking.
All the uncles and aunties, right?
Exactly. So, you know, I learned how to bake. My mom is a double-boarded physician, and she recognized early that I loved science. And so she taught me how to bake. So, you know, the story that's kind of funny here, Colin, is I say that as I got married and went into residency, my poor mother-in-law was thinking I'm going to feed her son cake and nothing else, you know. But the truth is I loved food, so I wanted to learn how to cook. But I also started to pay attention to what I was prescribing to my patients and understanding, therefore, that nutrition, which we know continues to be a gap in our medical education, is something that I could you know, talk about in the session, and we had also talked about lifestyle medicine and really bring that into the discussion with my patients. So it very early on in my career in psychiatry became an important part of what I was doing. So I decided to pursue things that I enjoyed, and I found that that inspired me, and I took myself to culinary school as you did, mm-hmm. mostly to follow a passion. And mm-hmm. the reality is that it came together in a very organic way for me. Mm-hmm. But I felt that, you know, patients with mental health and individuals struggling with mental health needed more in sort of their medical armor than just a medication. Mm-hmm. While I do prescribe medication, I felt from early on it was important to talk about lifestyle, talk about hydration, talk about, you know, movement, whatever appealed to that patient, mindfulness, you know, what did they feel they could do to make them feel better in addition to what I might have been prescribing, and then what they were eating. So it's, it evolved in that way for mm-hmm. me.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, I can just, I've been very, very privileged to have attended an actual Indian wedding in India.
Wow, there you go.
And I grew up with a lot of Indian friends, and my particular friend that I attended his wedding, I grew up, you know, during childhood, and he lived in Jaipur, and was able to visit the famous Golden Triangle, to see Agra, you know, New Delhi, and all that stuff. And, you know, I've always loved Indian food, and I've always been surrounded by, my friends and their parties, and, you know, there's always a party, right? There's always dancing, exactly. There's always food.
And there's always way too much food that anyone can actually eat, you know?
Exactly. And so as you're describing your extended family, I was just thinking to myself, all those different memories that brought back to me, you know, just, it was really, really, mm-hmm. really, I loved it.
I'm so glad to hear that, because they're a lot of fun. You know, the weddings are lot of fun. They're a little bit tiring because they go on for a long time. But the fun parts are the ceremony, the color, the flavors of the food, and, you know, everyone coming together. You don't just invite your immediate family. It's almost like you invite the whole village. So.
It was. And it's because traveling is a big passion of mine, and it's very fascinating to see how different cultures express themselves. And, you know, Indians, you know, it's through their food, it's through their dancing, you know, to me, it's like the two biggest highlights. And, you know, and the wedding, I think he had to shorten it. It was like 3 days. And for them, that was like short because it can go for like a week, right?
Exactly. Things can go on for a week. And, you know, the other thing, about the food that I think different cultures bring, as well as the spices, right? And those mm-hmm. have so many health benefits that we don't necessarily always talk about. So mm-hmm. that's also something that I kind of bring with me from my childhood, just learning about the things that we did. You know, turmeric was part of what we ate every day. Right. And so when I share it with my patients, it's not just because it's been discovered to be healthier or thought to be. You know, my grandmother would tell me this years ago. So
Yeah, and it's just like you said. It's one of my chef instructors. I had him on the first season when I interviewed him. He's Italian. Mm-hmm. He's an Italian American. Very, very deep Italian roots, but he actually went to an ashram for a year, and he taught himself, or he also learned Ayurvedic cooking. Wow. So Indian cooking is a very huge part of his repertoire. And
so interesting.
And what's interesting, the biggest thing that I remember from that interview was he said that Italian cooking is all about fresh ingredients, and mm-hmm. Indian cooking is all about the different, you know, combination of herbs and spices and the complexity of, you know, of the meals that came from that. And obviously there's a lot of health benefits, you know, from that as well. So, so along the way, when you were, you know, going through this journey, and then, you know, you got the cooking involved and, you know, all this other stuff. Has there been going a little bit deeper personally, has there anything, you know, from your own health journey that you had to extract, you know, from that added towards, you know, your practice and teaching people? Or were there other lessons that, you know, you just kind of, you know, learned along the way, either through patient accounts or other family members that kind of facilitated and added towards that journey towards the interaction between food and, you know, mental health?
Absolutely. I think it's almost a little bit of all of those, you know, in terms of what my family was rooted in. I think that I associated food with love and with bringing a sense of community that brought us together. And I learned that, you know, there were many delicious things I ate growing up, but not everything was completely healthy. So there were things about it. For example, what I took with me was those beautiful memories that I still hold in my heart. But I also then realized, as I understood nutrition and more about the culinary world, that you can take recipes that you enjoyed as a child and maybe make a slightly more healthy twist on them and still include the spices, which are calorie free, salt free, and pretty easy to incorporate, even if you don't cook Indian food. So you can add turmeric to a soup or you can add it to a smoothie, you know, with a pinch of black pepper to make it more active. So those things are things I drew on. And then in terms of what I found during residency, was that it was a very stressful time, and I really made that connection for myself between how I was starting to eat differently and crave different foods because I was stressed. And at the end of residency, as I kind of graduated,
stress during residency?
I know.
I've never heard of that one.
Well, until you go to culinary school, though, you know.
You know what I find really interesting is that there's actually very similar parallels between, you know, in the residency dynamics and hierarchy, and also in the kitchen hierarchy, right?
Absolutely. Did you
see that same parallel? I was like, this is very interesting.
So true. Absolutely. And so I just thought, well, you know, apparently at that point, I didn't know I was going to culinary school and making that decision. But I started to make that connection. I was eating differently. I live in Boston and it's a much colder climate. And so, you know, I remember saying to an aunt of mine, I'm craving candy and I'm just not much of a candy eater. And she explained that also, having moved from a warmer climate, that, you know, it's something, you know, she was a physician and she explained your body is starting to crave those foods because you're in a colder climate. And I started to early on make those connections that I think we almost understand so much better now. And I realized that I had to make a change to manage my own stress. And I had to, at the end of residency, really take a step back and eat more healthily and that kind of stuff. And, you know, I think that one of the things I would also like to share as I share my story is that I love food. And I think it's clear from our conversation that you do as well. And I think that we should be able to enjoy that wedding when we go to a friend's, you know, friend's wedding overseas and really have fun and really embrace the different flavors and the culture and the tastes and the joy. But then there's a way to reset, you know, there's a way to reset and go back to the healthy foods and your routine and that type of stuff. And I always share that with patients because I think that if we don't share that, then when we live in a very restricted sort of set of rules, and for me, that's when any one of us is set up to fail because it's too restricted.
Yeah, definitely. I can definitely agree. You know, with all of that, I mean, I think a lot about life is, you know, not black and white. A lot of it is gray. A lot of it is cloudy. You know, if given the chance, everything would just be mud. You know what I'm saying? It just wouldn't be, you know, just purely wet or purely dry. There's always going to be somewhere on the spectrum with you know, all this, you know what I'm saying? And patients. patients are very, very similar. You know, we are very, very similar. And Absolutely. So I think, you know, like you, like Dr. Uma and I, you know, we have gone through the routes of really practicing what we preach. And I love the fact that you've mentioned that, you know, when you go to weddings, you know, you don't really need to put yourself in a box and say to yourself, oh, I'm not going to have that or like, you know, have that. And for me, I focus on a plant predominant lifestyle, you know. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that I don't indulge, you know, in something non-plant, you know, right. Derived, you know. What I say to myself is, not necessarily, you know, with the concepts of moderation, but it's, you know, you're not poisoning yourself into that regard. It's more about, you know, that you can let yourself, you know, go for those moments, but just know that, you know, your foundation is heavily ingrained in, you know what is good for you and your body. And so that's important to talk about and relate to patients, because mm-hmm. I find that, you know, as a patient myself and, you know, seeing physicians and, you know, you want to be able to, the patient's perspective is really to understand that, hey, your provider is a human being as well. You know, your provider makes mistakes. You know, we fail. We, you know, have Absolutely. Missteps and miss, you know.
Yeah, none of us is perfect. Absolutely.
Exactly. And we learn from it. So, as you know, like nutrition is an evolving science. And so we make the best choices and educate ourselves based off the information that we have available today. So I appreciate you sharing that.
Well, thank you. And I also like what you said, Colin, about your, what you eat, because I think that too often people come into my office and are very polarized. They feel they have to either give up a food group, or they've been told, unless someone has an allergy or an intolerance that is very uncomfortable, mm-hmm. you know, they shouldn't be leaving out foods, unless they simply don't like something, you know. So I think that when things become polarized for people, they can't sustain it. So if they give up a certain type of food, I often see a boomerang effect. And it's not pleasant, because they feel like they failed at that point. And so I do think that having almost a sense of moderation, enjoy the good things. I talk about a cheat day, or what I've renamed that a treat day, actually. I used to call it a cheat day, but you know, in terms of, you know, being a psychiatrist and always trying to positively reframe things for people, like I talk about, you know, let's say your 7-day week starts on a Wednesday, always mm-hmm. have a day that maybe it's Wednesday for you, maybe it's Saturday for someone else, maybe someone who's doing emergency room shifts, it might be a different day of the week. But that day is the day that, you know, the family takes their turn in whatever they really most enjoy. And just mm-hmm. eat it in moderation, enjoy it, savor it, and the next day go back to your healthy eating, because it's, you know, and whether that could be that, you know, it could be a steak, or it could be more of a plant-based option, you know, but whatever mm-hmm. that person selects. Is important.
Exactly. And, you know, it's all about, it's kind of like coaching, you know, if anyone in the audience that's a health coach or life coach, is really about meeting people where they are at, right? And exactly. not to penalize them or punish them if they do something wrong. And, you know, it's all about 1%, you know, like just like moving the needle a little bit, 1% every single day, right?
Exactly.
Because for me, I care about progress over perfection. Mm-hmm. You know, like you, you know, I'm not a big fan of the word diet. I think it has a lot more negative connotations
Absolutely.
As opposed to positive. And it's really about, you know, just doing better than yesterday, you know? So, exactly. And we all want everyone to live in optimal health. And we just know that, you know, the evidence shows that a plant predominant, you know, foundation is the way to go. And,
Absolutely.
You know, we're not telling everyone to go vegan overnight. That's not what we're trying to say. So I'm curious, you know, coming from that, you know, Indian heritage and descent, you know, how much of what you do, is the balance between evidence-based of just nutrition versus, you know, do you also incorporate Ayurvedic, you know, theories into, you know, what you do?
So, you know, I think that's, I feel that what I've brought to my work is a deep understanding of Ayurveda. but and of course a healthy respect for it. But I also feel like I've had to adapt more personalized nutrition plans for what my patients come in asking, because often they're really struggling with the things that many of us are struggling with, you know, which diet should I follow? And again, I like what you said, because I try as much as possible not to use that word. And it's because that people feel they have to give something up. So when I talk about a lifestyle plan or what are they going to eat or even a meal plan, it's so much better. So I wouldn't say that I give people Ayurvedic treatment plans, but I use the principles sometimes in trying to guiding them through. And I try to share recipes from all worlds so that they can actually implement something. Because quite often they'll come to me and say, well, I saw, you know, this clinician and I got a list of stuff that I should follow, but what do I actually do? I had a patient unexpectedly, just because I guess that in my head there was a preformed opinion about this, which I realized was a bias, but, you know, from a businesswoman, actually. And she said to me, you know, Dr. Naidu, you keep telling me to eat avocados and that they're a healthy fat, but I have no idea of what to do with them. You know, that was really helpful for me to know, because she mostly didn't cook at home. And part of her journey has been to start to learn to make even simple things for herself and embrace healthy eating that way. But, you know, she would buy it and she wouldn't know whether it was right, whether it was, you know, she could eat it. What should she do with it? How should she cut it? And so, you know, I think not understanding that one should not make assumptions around food, also walking people through a simple thing like what you can, how you can make a vinaigrette and save on, you know, the added calories, the added sodium, the preservatives from, and the expense of a store-bought salad dressing. Just simple things that you can walk them through really make a difference. So I tend to meet, like you said, meet the person where they're at. If they're interested in something from Ayurveda, I'll bring it in. But I wouldn't say it's the basis of the food treatment plans that I designed.
Right.
Hey guys, we're going to be taking a short break, but don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Thrive Bites. Let's get back to the interview.
Right. And I think being personalized is the way to go. You know, there was something that I've learned through my health coaching, you know, training way back when, and it's the concept of bio-individuality. And it's really about, you know, there's no diet that fits everyone, right? You kind of have to figure out all their attributes, you know, not just their medical history and family history, but, you know, what are their preferences, you know, from a culinary, you know, perspective, what are their preferences, what are their tastes like, you know, what do they resonate with? What do they, you know, what are they more adverse with? You know, figuring out what kind of palate or, you know, figuring out how adventurous they are.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. So there's just so many things.
Exactly. And it totally, you know, links back to all the emerging research around the gut microbiome and how, you know, everyone is encouraging a diversity of plants or a diversity of foods and diversity of fiber, you know, to encourage, because the microbiome is so unique to each one of us. So it ties into that as well.
Yeah, definitely. So I love to kind of segue into that and learn more about, you know, your current work, which is, you know, you have a book that says This Is Your Brain on Food, and you talk about concepts in it, you know, for example, neuroinflammation, neurooxidative stress, the gut, you know, connection. Can you go over the basics of that and give a sense of breaking that down, what is it that you have found and learned, you know, with your research with it?
Sure. So I would like to probably start with what I think drives most of it, even though they're all interconnected. And that is sort of the gut-brain axis, because many people don't realize that 90% of the serotonin, in fact, slightly more of the serotonin receptors are located in the gut. And, you know, Colin, we know from anatomy and embryology that the gut and the brain are connected by the vagus nerve. What also happens with these connections is because there's the bidirection of new chemicals and substances traveling between the gut and the brain. When we eat, you know, say processed foods or sugary foods or foods that are generally unhealthy for us, the gut is disrupted, and the mm-hmm. good bacteria in the gut, and each one of us is so unique in what we have in our guts, is disrupted. So that disruption then impacts how and what is sent up and down to the brain. Mm-hmm. So very simply, some of the things that could happen are inflammation. You could mm-hmm. have inflammation of the gut and then inflammation of the brain. It's not always clear which one starts first, but we do think that the gut imbalance is where we think that it emerges from. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the fact that when serotonin is impacted, your mood and anxiety, because all of our pharmaceuticals in psychiatry are based on either serotonin, epinephrine, dopamine, and all the mm-hmm. major neurotransmitters. Mm-hmm. So if you just think about the fact that there are serotonin receptors in the gut and this imbalance occurs, it's going to affect certain symptoms. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, it evolves into other things that get involved, such as stress. So mm-hmm. stress, just physical stress, mental stress becomes, it evolves within your body in the sense that stress affects the HPA axis, affects your cortisol, disrupts your mm-hmm. gut. And before mm-hmm. you know it, you know, you having neurooxidative stress. So it doesn't just sit in your gut, it also impacts your brain. So what I've basically done in the book is we reviewed probably about 700 research papers. And we narrowed it down, we whittled it down to really make it digestible to people to read through the different mm-hmm. conditions, foods that they should embrace and foods that they should avoid. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think that the theme throughout the book is how does the gut impact this, and what can you do to eat differently? And, you know, I don't say this in the book, but I often talk about it this way, you know, it's, why did your grandmother, your mother tell you to eat your salad? You know, because it actually turns out to be a pretty healthy ingredient, you know, greens uh-huh, are good for uh-huh. you. So it's using those principles and tying it together for people, but then also dividing it up into different disease models. But also, you know, someone who may be anxious may also have mood symptoms. So they might look at a few chapters in the book. So therefore, there's also some overlap of the foods that uh-huh. run as a theme throughout. And then at the end, you know, we share recipes. And I think you'll relate to this, Colin. I felt it was important to help people, like my patient who didn't know what to do with an avocado, to set up a kitchen. You know, what is mise en place? Like, what does it mean to just break it down for yourself? Get yourself set up for success, you know, and get things ready so that you can do batch cooking. You can effectively make a few things at a time to de-stress your life, but also be healthy, have healthy options in your fridge. And then, you know, we shared some recipes based on each chapter.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. I love it. Yeah. So I mean, the mind gut body connection has been, oh man, in the literature for a very, very long time.
It has.
And I'm not sure why certain world event, the pandemic definitely brings it out more, as we have seen, you know, emphasizing mm-hmm. the gut health, emphasizing immunity.
Yes.
You know, now, you know, we know that about 70% of it lives in our gut, you know.
Yes.
You know, I don't know why it comes in and out of people's consciousness, but, you know, the evidence and research has been there for a very, very long time.
You're right.
For our audience members that are not healthcare related, you know, conceptually, you know, how would you think about inflammation? You know, the way I describe inflammation for patients is kind of like, you know, chronic inflammation is kind of like, you know, like a bucket or maybe like okay. a bathtub, right? Mm-hmm. And it just slowly, slowly just kind of fills up over time, where after a while, whether it's, you know, increase oxidative stress, or, you know, diet-wise, eating more unhealthy, you know, foods like the processed foods, like you're referring to, the sugar, the high refined sugars, fried foods, anything like that, or, you know, even land animals, anything, you know, because there's mm-hmm. so much research about all that, that there seems to be like a tipping point where, mm-hmm. you know, if you imagine a bucket and it fills up to the top, and once it has that tipping point and starts to overflow, I conceptually, you know, relay to patients that this is where different types of lifestyle-related chronic diseases manifest. Mm-hmm. And it just turns out, it just manifests differently for different people, whether it's diabetes, whether it's heart disease, and things like that. So is there, how do you conceptualize it for patients, you know, in that way?
And I agree with what you said. You know, this information has been around for ages, and I feel like that I didn't learn enough about it until later in my career. Mm-hmm. And as I also started to appreciate the connection, the way that I try to unpack it for people is to talk about, you know, talk about, say, an example of a processed food that they might be enjoying, and say it's a snack that they have at work every afternoon, and they, you know, continue to eat it. And they notice in their life that, you know, they might be doing that because of stress. So there's that important connection. And I try to explain it through, which is inflammation as well, is through sort of what people commonly read in the news, you know, or see in the media, called leaky gut. Mm-hmm. And basically, because that really directly describes to them that there are endotoxins formed by the bacteria that are initially good guys in the gut. You know, they're trying to do the right thing. There's always a few bad bugs around as well to create that balance. But when you feed your gut the wrong foods, and by that I mean sort of the unhealthy foods, you know, that we shouldn't be making a habit of, the bad bacteria thrive. So they just gobble up the sugar. They just, you know, enjoy the processed foods and things like that. But they also then create whatever they're doing in the intestinal permeability of the gut or the gut mm-hmm. wall, is that things start to leak through. And these chemicals also reach the brain. What someone might notice is that they have irritable bowel, or they have, you know, bouts of diarrhea or discomfort, or they can't tolerate eating a meal that they previously ate. Mm-hmm. And they're wondering to themselves, oh, am I allergic to something? And it may not be that at all. It might just be that they have significant inflammation. The, mm-hmm. the connection I try to make to them is that the inflammation from the gut reaches the brain. So it's this it's a two-way connection. Mm-hmm. It's up and down mm-hmm. all the time. And therefore, over time, if they continue to eat that bag of chips or the fast food and things like that, mm-hmm. and, you know, for example, mm-hmm. many people don't realize that fast food French fries have added sugar because mm-hmm. research and development has shown that they're much more delicious, and who could not, yep. you know, go up a size in the size of the French fries that you want because they're delicious and you can't stop eating them. What's the reason mm-hmm. for that? Research and development has gone into that. And so mm-hmm. We don't taste the sugar, but it's there. So, mm-hmm. you know, there are many times when we're talking about fast foods, it's the saturated fats, it's the unhealthy oils and all of that. All of those things directly affect the lining of your intestine or the lining of your gut. And yeah. and that's where the inflammation starts. And someone might actually present with depression first, or someone might present with irritable bowel or an inflammatory disease or an autoimmune disease. Of course, yeah. you have to go through your physician and who will help with the diagnosis. But I Correct. Ask my patients just not to ignore that one thing they can start to do differently is start to eat differently as they're doing everything else.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think it's as simple as saying, you know, you have generalized anxiety disorder or depression, and it's due to a lack of Prozac, right? Exactly. So it's not as simple as that, you know? Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Colin. I was also going to say, you know, people do not fall into the categories that our diagnostic and statistical manual present. And many of my patients simply don't. And it is the guide that we use to help diagnosis and treatment. But many mm-hmm. people come in with what I consider to be subsyndromal emotions, meaning, mm-hmm. or you know, they have anxiety, they're functioning, they don't feel good. And mm-hmm. so they're not necessarily meeting criteria, and you know they'll end up contacting me because they want to find other ways to feel better. So mm-hmm. you know the diagnostic categories don't capture everyone either.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. So, and that's important to know, because I think from a healthcare from a physician point of view, let's just say we're not practicing as holistically, right? And we're not considering food and lifestyle. And we're just relying on, you know, what we have now is the DSM-5, which is basically a gigantic Bible of, you know, words and vocabulary to help us categorize and put people in boxes, essentially. Okay. And, you know, and it's important to, and they're great, and it's very much needed to provide a structure. But like you said, it doesn't really capture everyone in the in-betweens, quote unquote. And exactly. So we kind of have to
in
look
in those gray zones. Exactly.
Yes. And we have to look further and we have to look beyond. And, you know, that's why we are pursuing, you know, looking at it from a holistic, you know, point of view. And going back to your original talk about the permeability of intestinal wall, I don't know a lot of people know about this, but the intestinal wall, your colon, your gastroenteritis, depending on which part, it's almost as thin as, you know, if you've ever eaten sausage, right? Mm-hmm. And the lining that is used to create sausage, it's literally almost as thin as that.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, if you can picture it, how fragile and mm-hmm. how, you know, how much we can change that type of structure at anatomical level, you can just see how there's like a whole host of things that could come up if we don't treat our bodies well. So mm-hmm. It's very important. You know, we've been talking about these concepts. And so, you know, so give us some case studies in terms of how you direct this with a patient. Like, for example, you know, do you do this on a one-on-one or are you able to give, you know, talks and demonstrates, you know, this, you know, for people? Because using food as medicine, quote unquote, you know, it's a very, it's very hard to just talk about it. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
In my experience, you need frequency of visits. Sometimes it's better to talk as a group because you have a lot of great peer-to-peer interaction, or if you're able to do shared medical appointments or group medical visits, that's a fantastic way of conveying information as well. So how do you go about teaching these concepts to your patients?
Sure. So I start off in the office, and then one of the things that I've done, we are actually building out programming that will involve group sessions with sort of cooking demos that integrate the nutrition as well as the sort of the mental health science behind what we're doing. But that is to come and was actually somewhat held up because of COVID. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But some of what I've switched to doing even before COVID was some individuals who may not need to travel into the office, we would do sessions online where I would instruct them through cooking in their own kitchen. So, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. we would come up with a personalized plan for them. We'd work on the nutrition, what they needed to do, what their symptoms were, what we were working on. I'd send them ahead of time a grocery list and tell them the recipes, give them the recipes so they could practice after our session was done, and then really work with them and tell them why we're doing what we're doing. So, mm-hmm. you know, almost the what I really wrote about in chapter 11 in my book was setting up the kitchen, giving them those simple, so taking someone who, say, has a kitchen but doesn't really cook, mm-hmm. and really starting with those basics with someone else. It could be that they're a very effective cook and they just want to learn what are the ingredients that I should be using in my meals. And let's work on some recipes together and, you know, kind of demo with them how to walk through very, very simple, straightforward recipes so that they can start to implement that. A great example was an individual who didn't cook, had a wonderful kitchen, and really shared with me that it would really matter to her that when her teenage daughters brought their friends home, that she could do something more than order takeout pizza. And she was also understanding through our work together that that wasn't the healthiest choice. Great for a treat once in a while. But if after basketball practice, they were coming over once a week because her home was closest, she wanted to do more than that. And you know, she really was starting to make that connection that she wanted to offer healthier choices. So, you know, we started off with hummus and something where she didn't necessarily have to do the chickpeas from scratch. She could get an organic can of chickpeas and how to work with it and how to use a food processor, which she'd really not used before. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. all she had to do was, even if she didn't initially learn how to chop up vegetables, she could buy a fresh crudité platter that was available at the supermarket and mm-hmm. offer them a start off with a healthy snack and then build it. Then we taught her how to make a really nutritious salad and to grill chicken so that in the simplest of ways, she was then able to give them a healthy snack when they walked into the door, provide a salad with a protein side. In this case, she made chicken, but how to do it in a way that felt composed. And she did the chicken on the side. So the friends that were vegetarian or didn't eat, or were more plant-based could have that. But she also learned to add in nutrients that brought protein into the salad, nuts, seeds, other legumes mm-hmm. and things like that. So she, mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't a ton of recipes, but she was so happy and felt so accomplished that she had done these things that she continues to practice those 3 to 5 simple recipes with her family and her friends. Mm-hmm. And she's been able to expand her, well, not during COVID, but expand her social circle by doing that as well. Because she can invite people over, you know, and was really experiencing a greater sense of community through
yes.
that.
Hey guys, we're going to be taking a short break, but don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Thrive Bites. Let's get back to the interview.
Yes. And I'm sure you agree that, you know, and I think this, you know, this occurs globally, that nothing really brings people together more so than food. You know, food, in my opinion, is like the common denominator across all cultures. And it's, you know, kind of like music and dance and art.
Exactly.
It's another language.
Exactly.
It's another language of how you express. And I love the fact that you shared that because, you know, you're starting very, very basic, right? Mm-hmm. You're taking a case where, you know, maybe not everyone wants to actually cook, right? But
exactly.
there's other aspects of cooking in terms of very simple preparation, right?
Exactly.
And, you know, and this is also great because it also is able to include, you know, her children, and then they're able to bring their friends over. And like you said, that raises and fosters the relationship between, you know, like a very, very small community. Right. And it's easy. I mean, nowadays, you know, anyone can call, you know, for takeout, you know, now anyone can push an app and have things delivered. That's easy.
Right.
I think the challenging, but the most rewarding experience is really about preparing something for yourself and preparing
exactly.
something, you know, for others. So I think that's great. With your patients, how have you been able to measure how they've been improved? Is it mostly through like symptomatic feedback, or is it, you know, through their how they improve in their culinary skills, or, you know, how have you been able to kind of measure their feedback in terms of, you know, when you counsel them or, you know, as you're going along with them?
Sure, that's a great question. So it's based on, you know, symptomatology. So mm-hmm. symptoms and scales of mood, things like mood, anxiety, that I do, even if it's a virtual visit, we still assess that. So I really want to make sure that their symptoms are improving. And for example, that they haven't gotten, you know, more depressed in the sense that they might be trying out these different means of using nutritional strategies, but for other reasons, they may be not feeling good. So that's why we assess them symptomatically as well. The other aspect is culinary skills and how are they eating. So if they are improving their nutrition, I've noticed a very clear uptick of improvement of how they're doing overall. Lower stress, just a better mood, managing difficult situations that a month ago they would have found super stressful, they're coping better. So understanding that there's that connection between how they're eating, even making a simple salad. Like you said, it doesn't have to be, you know, you don't have to start with a souffle, but you can actually start with a simple green salad and a vinaigrette to get someone started. And that accomplishment means that they're immediately bringing in healthy fiber and fruits and vegetables into their diet. And then, you know, the other component is, you know, once in a while, there are two things that I do run into. One is orthorexia, where someone is really so fixated on a certain health benefit and being almost slightly, they're really healthy, they're aiming to do the right thing, but it gets to be extreme. And have to then work with them around, you know, how can you still employ those healthy habits but create more of a balance? And the other issue that I sometimes run into is that for a different reason, either someone experiences a medical illness that, you know, they have to, had a patient who has pretty significant asthma. And unfortunately, she went through this cycle a few years ago where she started to get persistent chest infections to the point that they needed hospitalization, which doesn't usually happen for chest infections. So these were severe. And the infectious disease doctor was treating her had to use antibiotics, antifungal agents, really to help her get better. And each time, you know, she would come to me and she would tell me she knew that her gut was disrupted and what should she do. So, you know, we would work around each episode and then working with her on nutritional strategies to feel better. Because what she noticed is not only was she fatigued after these hospitalizations, but she was, beyond that, she was starting to feel depressed and anxious, and a person who had never suffered with any of these conditions throughout her life. So, you know, it's really, like you said, meeting someone where they're at, figuring out what they need. And in those specific situations, if they have a medical condition that, you know, that we're not in control of and that is going to impact their eating and their nutrition, then we have to find other ways to implement change.
Yeah. No, that's great because, you know, I think one of the best things about longitudinal care or primary care for me, it's having that rapport and relationship and being able to see them ever so often. You know, with lifestyle related counseling, it's seeing them more frequently so we can track the progress and see how they're doing, and for them to feel comfortable enough to be able to give that feedback and say like, oh, hey doc, you know, I kind of messed up here, or you know, went a wrong turn here, and then you work with them to kind of get them going, you know what I'm saying? So that's great. What are some common misconceptions when you were researching or just from your practice experience in terms of, you know, nutritional and food related questions with the mind, with the brain? You know, what are some common misconceptions that you find from different people?
Sure. So some of the misconceptions people have are that many individuals will ask me at a lecture or other presentation, should I be eating fruit? You talk about, you know, including fruit and vegetables in the diet, but isn't that too much sugar for me? And, you know, I think that it's really about understanding the balance and understanding that fiber is in fruit and vegetables and legumes and nuts and seeds and things like that. But it's not in animal proteins or seafood proteins. So it's not only is it a healthy source of fiber for your gut bacteria, but it's really the fact that you're getting so many nutrients and vitamins and antioxidants, say, even from a bowl of blueberries, than you would from something that wasn't a fruit. Also, the added value is the added value that it's bringing to your body is far more important than whatever you're concerned about regarding the sugar. Also, studies have shown that those do not necessarily negatively impact you if you're eating, you know, the appropriate serving sizes. And portion sizes, of course, become really important. So often people feel they have to exclude fruit because it's too many calories and they've gone on a special diet and they can't eat it. I think it's all about the balance. And if I say to my patients, again, in a personalized way, if you notice that you eat a certain fruit and you have a certain symptom, tell me about it. And we can course correct and figure out what that is. If something's not making you feel well or uncomfortable, obviously we should change that. But, you know, a few pieces of fruit and appropriate sizes of berries and eating that every day is just a good idea for you. And frozen is fine as long as there's no added sugar, syrup, or preservatives as well, especially, you know, in the times that we're facing now. At the beginning of the pandemic, the, you know, supermarket shelves were empty and people were very worried about what they would get. So, you know, frozen foods and that type of stuff became important options for people to understand that they were healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And we talked about frozen food when I had the COVID wellness series during season two, and I've interviewed a couple people and saying that, you know, frozen foods, you know, people are buying things that are, you know, more non-perishables, right? Things on shelves, and we find that frozen food is perfect because it's, you know, you're picking it at the peak, you know, of exactly. when they're grown, and then just freezing it, and we can store it for longer periods of time, and it's, you know, fantastic. So, Uma, this has been Dr. Uma, this has been amazing. I definitely want to close out. I'm sure we can talk forever. I love to hear about my guests in terms of how they personally thrive. So, mm-hmm. you know, the centerpiece of the podcast is really about how does one get up in the morning? You know, what mm-hmm. drives them? What fuels their fire? So my first part is, how do you personally thrive, mm-hmm. you know, on a personal level? And then the second part is more action oriented for the audience. So give us three tips for our audience on how they can jumpstart their brain/minds with food. And mm-hmm. I'll turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you. So I think this is a hard one for me because I always have so much to say about food. But if I were to say to someone, you know, where can you start? I would say certain things and tell them why. I'd really like them to eat more fruits and vegetables because the fiber in these help your gut bacteria. And by helping your gut bacteria in a good way, you're going to emotionally be better and several health conditions will also improve. So start there if you can and pay attention to that. The next thing I would tell them is, you know that soda has a lot of sugar, but you should also realize that savory foods contain a lot of sugar that you don't realize. For example, pasta sauces have a very large amount of sugar. You don't realize that in addition to the tomatoes, which actually as an ingredient are healthy, there are added sugars that you need to watch. So when you're buying things from the supermarket, be aware of that because you may not realize that. I also like to share with people that our food labels are in grams and we cook in ounces and pounds. So I like to teach my patients that 4 grams of sugar is 1 teaspoon. And so if they look at a food label, they can roughly calculate if they look at a fruited yogurt and there's 24 grams of sugar in a small yogurt, would you really be adding 6 teaspoons of sugar if you had a plain yogurt? Probably not. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The third thing I sort of bundle into sort of one category, and I say all of the foods that you eat and that I will help work with you on to eat healthier are important. And you'll see the food list in my book. But, you know, remember that lifestyle, sleep, energy, paying attention to your memory, exercising, spending time outdoors, having a sense of community, being with your family or your friends, all of that is important. And I sort of put that in, it's a much larger category than that. But to try to be concise, I want to share with them that this is a holistic and integrated approach. And it's not going to work if you only just eat well. Just like you can't exercise out of a bad diet, you know, in a similar way, you can't feel emotionally better just by eating. It's one of the many components, but it's the thing you can control the best because you have to eat every day. And it's something you can change.
Definitely, definitely. And I tell my patients that, you know, don't focus on things that you cannot control, focus on things you can. Exactly. And so when they are able to reshift how they look at, you know, different things, one, it definitely minimizes their stress and anxiety, especially during, you know, our time when, you know, when you have the virus that's running around, you know, we could easily, you know, go down that rabbit hole of, you know, what's going to happen and, you know, what, you know, X, Y, and Z. And it just fills people up with fear. And I tell them, listen, you know, everyone's doing the best we can. Learn as much as you can, educate yourself and focus on things you can control, you know? And I agree with you. It's not a one-stop shop in terms of food. I love food. I love cooking. So do you. And, you know, it is a huge component, but it's also a puzzle piece amongst everything else, you know, of a larger puzzle. And so, you know, but a puzzle that we are more and more, you know, figuring out. So, but it's the fun of not having the complete picture. But hey, you know, we're getting there as close as we can. So,
absolutely. I couldn't agree more. In fact, you said it so much better. So thank you.
No, you're good. You're good. And the first question was, yes. How do you personally thrive? Yes.
I feel that part of it comes from my Hindu roots, but I also feel like many people do this, and it kind of grounds me. You know, I wake up and I practice gratitude. I no matter how difficult my on-call was the night before or my day might be ahead, I take a moment to center myself in that way. And I try to remember three things that I'm grateful about that had happened, say, in the past 24 hours. I practice some type of simple meditation. I grew up in a family that taught me how to meditate. So I do, even if I can do it for 10 minutes at some point in my morning, before I start my day, I find it centers me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people would call that prayer, whatever it is that works for you. For me, it's mindfulness, gratitude, and really centering myself in being grounded around feeling that I've sort of brought up in a family of physicians. And so we have a strong basis of sort of being of service to the community and being of service to humanity. And I think that I try to remember that when I get up in the day that's important to me. And it was how I was raised. And it connects me back to the love and the family, you know, the family from whence I came.
Yeah. Yeah. That's beautiful. Yeah. And you can tell that the family and cultural roots are very, very strong. And, you know, it's important to reflect on where you come from and, you know, how has that brought you to this point. So, you know, it's very, very, very lovely. So
thank you.
Thank you so much for being on the show and sharing your time and insights in today's session. If people out there want to look you up or learn more about you or, you know, want to get your book, where can they find you?
I have a website where you can find the book and a little video which tells you about the book. It's umanaidoomd.com, which is umanaidoo.com. And you can find me there, find out information, sign up for our newsletter, and, you know, it'll just provide a little bit more information.
Awesome. Awesome. And I'll put that into the show notes, you know, once the episode is out for everyone to see. Thank you so much for coming on again. I really appreciate you and your work. Guys, this has been another episode of Thrive Bites. If you like this, please subscribe and follow. And if you feel this is a benefit for someone else, please share this as well. And we will see you on the next episode.
Hey guys, that was another episode of Thrive Bites. If you liked that episode, please subscribe and follow for new episodes. And don't forget to rate us on Apple Podcasts.